Do humans have a blueprint for goodness? Yale sociologist and physician Nicholas Christakis is perhaps best known for his work on social networks, how they affect our health and our behavior. His new book takes on an even bigger question: are human beings hardwired for good? His answer, provocatively, is yes. He argues that humans are evolutionarily wired to be kind and to create strong societies. He believes that social science has been focused too much on the dark side of human nature, and he is aiming to change the conversation. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The book is called Blueprint: The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society, and Nicholas Christakis is our guest today. What are your questions about human nature and whether good wins out? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is easy to look around at our society and see divisiveness and strife, but a new book by our guest, Nicholas Christakis, sees things in a more optimistic light. Today, we'll hear more about his research and his new book, Blueprint: The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. He joins us from VPR Studios, Vermont Public Radio Studios in Norwich, Vermont. Professor Nicholas Christakis is a sociologist, physician, and author. He directs the Human Nature Lab at Yale University, where he is the Sterling Professor of Social and Natural Science and is co-director of the Yale Institute for Network Scientists. Yale Institute for Network Science. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you believe human beings are hardwired to be good? What questions do you have for Professor Nicholas Christakis? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Nicholas Christakis, welcome to Maine Calling. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In your book, you're taking on a pretty big question, which is, are human beings wired to be good, and are we wired to create good societies? Before I ask you about your answer, which is yes, I want to ask you, why did you decide to take on this question of whether humans are inherently good?
Well, I mean, my sense from working as a hospice doctor, I practiced medicine until 10 years ago, taking care of people who were dying in underprivileged communities. From studying social phenomena, you know, in the United States and in sort of villages around the world, my laboratory does these public health experiments in various places around the world. Was that something was missing from popular accounts, which depict humans as, you know, horribly rapacious and selfish, and who have sort of somehow been grudgingly brought to heel in the last 200 years by, you know, civilizing forces. And we have been brought to heel. Let me be clear. I do think that I agree, for example, with Steven Pinker and others who are arguing that in the last 200 years since the Enlightenment, or 300 years, you know, our world has become more peaceful and more healthy, and we become longer lived as a result of technological and social forces. But I don't think we needed those forces to be good. I think, in fact, it's a gross misreading of our evolutionary history, or at least an incomplete one, to think that somehow we are these horrible people. And I think that the scientific record and our public conversation about it could use a corrective. So I'm not interested in offering some kind of trivially Pangalossian, you know, best of all possible worlds account. Like, I'm not ignorant. I'm aware that every century, every millennium is replete with horrors. But I do think we have overlooked these very fundamental, you know, aspects of human nature. And I think that we need to recognize that we have not just evolved under the shape of these forces to be violent, or to be prone to hatred or tribalism or selfishness. We have also been shaped to love each other and befriend each other and cooperate with each other and teach each other. And I would argue that those forces, those positive forces, must necessarily have been, and in fact were, stronger, more powerful than the forces for badness. So that's a little bit about why I wrote the book and a bit about the argument.
Well, I'm thinking of the news just this week, from the Easter Sunday church attack in Sri Lanka to the news that 60 doctors and other medical professionals are being charged with opioid pushing across several states. It seems as though the prevalence of greed and violence are on full display in this world.
Yes, they...
How do you... They all, given that, yeah, how do you say humans are inherently good?
No, but first of all, they always have been. So first of all, let's not forget that, bad as the news may seem around the world, with incompetent leadership in countries around the world, attacks by Islamic terrorists in Sri Lanka, who use bombs in churches, for example, or white nationalists in New Zealand who, you know, go into a mosque and kill people with machine guns or semi-automatic weapons. There is, as I said, every century, every year, every moment, there are obviously these awful things we can point to. But I would like to remind ourselves that not 50 or 60 years ago, we had a world war in which millions of people were killed. We had atomic weapons that were exploded in Japan. We had the Holocaust. We have had pogroms and inquisitions. We have had warfare for a very long time. And it's clearly bad. I'm not unaware of these things, nor should we be, nor should we be complacent. But things are better than they were 50 or 60 years ago. Moreover, my argument is not even about what's been happening in the last few hundred or even few thousand years. I'm interested in the evolutionary history that has shaped who we are over hundreds of thousands of years. So all of these forces that we're discussing, the Inquisitions, the Holocaust, the wars throughout the world, all of those are forces which have appeared in our history, but our prehistory is more powerful and even older, and it's that is the primary focus of my interest.
The title of the book is Blueprint. You believe humans, as humans, we carry an evolutionary blueprint for making a good society. And in the book you write, I do not mean that genes are the blueprint. I mean that genes act to write the blueprint. Professor, that's a lot to get your head around.
Yes.
Can you expand? How can we know what part of human nature itself is on our genes?
Yeah. So first of all, one initial approach to that is to look around the world and see what do human beings share? What are the fundamental aspects of our common humanity? What are the universal traits seen around the world? And I'm interested, just to emphasize and to clarify, there are parts of our human nature that we can have on our own. So if you were a hermit on a mountain or you lived by yourself, you would be prone to certain things that all humans might be. You might have wanderlust, or you might have religious sensibilities, for example. Those have been shaped by natural selection too, but you could experience those on your own. What I'm interested in is those parts of our human nature that we express in connection with others. That is to say, how do we come together to form a society? And I argue that natural selection has shaped not just the structure and function of our bodies, you know, whether we are tall or prone to diabetes, not just the structure and function of our minds, you know, how intelligent we are, how risk-averse we are, but also the structure and function of our societies. How do we form societies? Of all the possible ways we could do that. And one insight into the way that natural selection or our evolution has shaped that is to look around the world for common features. That's one approach. And when we do that, we find a very interesting thing. For instance, we find that the propensity to love the people we have sex with is seen throughout the world. Why? Why? We could have evolved as a species to mate with each other. Many animals do this, but we don't just mate with each other. We form an attachment to our partners, the people with whom we're having sex. And this occurs in monogamous societies, in polygynous and polyandrous, among homosexual couples. This is a human universal, this attachment we feel to our mates, with one interesting exception, which I discuss in the book. In addition, we also, everywhere around the world, we befriend each other. This is also very odd. You know, we form long-term, non-reproductive unions with other members of our species. Other animals don't do this, but we humans do, again, with some interesting exceptions. So elephants do it, certain whale species do it, certain primates do it, which is also interesting. But we befriend each other, and this is seen in every society around the world, again, with very few and interesting exceptions. And I could go on. We cooperate with each other. When people meet a stranger in most societies, like in our society, we start typically by being kind to them, by being willing to engage in cooperation with them. We teach each other stuff. This is very unusual in the animal kingdom. Teaching is a kind of altruism. The teacher gives of themselves, sacrifices some time, let's say, and gives some knowledge to another person. Many animals learn. A little fish in the sea can learn that if it sees the light and swims up, it will find food there. Some animals learn socially. They copy each other. So, for example, I see you put your hand in the fire, and I learn, oh my goodness, you got burned. That's very efficient social learning. The alternative would be I put my own hand in the fire and I get burned, so I pay a price for the knowledge I acquire. Or I could watch you put your hand in the fire and I pay none of the price and get almost as much knowledge. But we don't even just do that. We set out to teach each other stuff. This, again, is universal. It's seen everywhere around the world where one human being teaches someone else. So these wonderful qualities, love, friendship, cooperation, teaching, and others are seen universally, and they're very powerful, and they necessarily compensated or countermanded our propensity to violence and hatred and all the other bad things we discussed.
As you've been alluding to in Blueprint, you outline a social suite of capacities and identify these as you said, the capacity to have and recognize individual identity, love for partners and offspring, friendship, social networks, cooperation, preference for one's own group, the in-group bias, mild hierarchy, social learning and teaching. And I think the benefits of most of these, love, friendship, social networks, cooperation, is self-evident. But not all of them. And so I want to talk about the concept of in-group bias and why that can be a positive thing. I mean, right now our society seems to be increasingly tribal, and it doesn't really seem like a good thing. What do you mean by in-group bias?
Right. So that is tribalism, that the sort of the drawing a distinction between us versus them and then thinking well of us and ill of them. And this is also a cultural universal. It is a part of our human nature. It's seen everywhere. And it is relevant. It is one of the tools that natural selection has given us to make it possible for us to cooperate. So many of the elements of the social suite, this list of traits that natural selection has shaped to make it possible for us to live socially, arose or exist in order to make it easier for us to work together. So let me just give. Let me just step back a moment, and then maybe we can come back to an explanation of this. By stepping back, what I'd like to do is to say, if it was the case that whenever I came near you, you were violent towards me, or you killed me, or you filled me with lies, you gave me misinformation or fake news, there would be no reason for me to be with you. I'd be better off living an isolated life. So we would be solitary creatures. So the benefits of a connected life must have outweighed the costs. It was the case that the benefits outweigh the cost. But how we go about achieving those benefits, we need a bunch of tools. And in-group bias is one of the tools. And what it does is it reduces the sense of scale. So if you're in a very large population of people, instead of you being expected to cooperate with everyone, you only cooperate with a subgroup, those people you deem part of us. And that actually plays a role in our ability to cooperate with each other. So it can become tribalism, and often does become, and this is very depressing to me, does become a vile part of our nature, but at its core, it has to do with how we cooperate with each other.
I was struck by the randomness of this idea of an in-group bias and the experiment with children in shirt color. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is, you know, you've sort of hit upon the part that's the most depressing to me, which is, you know, this us versus them mentality that we humans have, which, as I said, serves a good purpose. But it's so easy to elicit in human beings. You can randomly assign children, 3 and 4 year olds, to different T-shirt colors. They know that there's no reason other than chance that they were assigned to these colors. But little children assigned to get yellow colors immediately conclude that the little children assigned to get green T-shirt colors, that those children deserve to be punished and they don't deserve as many toys and they are worse. So even a trivial, exogenously imposed distinction calls forth in humans this us versus them mentality, and it can do so even in children as young as 3 and 4. It's even younger, actually, in some different experiments. So it's a fundamental part of our nature. It does depress me to some extent, but it has a purpose. I should say, there are ways to efface that tribalism. We have evolution has equipped us with other tools that would allow us to push against this, the bad consequences of this tribalism when it's overdone.
Can you talk about those?
Yeah, so I'm mindful about the break that's coming up. So I,
you know, don't worry about
get,
me.
And I can get very long winded. You know, I'm like a professor. You just start me talking, and then I just go and go. So, I'm trying to. But let me just cultivate the following intuition. Imagine that you have a large population. Let's say our society. And above, and then below that, you have these groups defined, let's say, by religion or language or by whatever attribute or t-shirt color. And below that, you have the constituent individuals. One way to efface the tribalism of groups and address, in fact, one of the political problems facing our society today is to step up a level to the level of the population and to take advantage of the fact that we draw these groups arbitrarily, right? Like the t-shirt example shows how arbitrary the groups are. And you can efface the tribalism of small groups by an appeal to the inclusion of large groups. You can say, we are all Americans. We are all part of the American idea. Now, we've not always lived up to those political aspirations, but the idea is very powerful. E pluribus unum. You know, we are all part of the American project. You know, you just come to this country, you buy the Bill of Rights, you agree to the Bill of Rights, you adopt certain political beliefs about the equality of people, and you're an American. We're unusual on this planet in our having that definition. You know, many countries are defined along ethnic grounds. You know, it's not easy to become a member of those countries, but not in our country. So one response to the tribalism of groups at the middle level is to go up a level. And this has been appreciated about our society since the founders, in fact, and since the very first observers like de Tocqueville. But another strategy is to go down a level and to recognize that would require long digression, but one of the things that evolution has equipped us with, which is amazing, is the capacity to be individuals. So each of us has a unique face. Why? Why do we have unique faces? Other animals don't have the capacity to signal their individuality. Not only that, but you can look out at a sea of 1,000 faces and tell everyone apart from everyone else. So your brain has a lot of capacity that's allocated to telling the difference between individuals. This ability to signal our individuality and to detect it is an evolutionary luxury that our species and certain other species like elephants and whales and certain primates have. And it is paradoxically, this capacity to be individuals is required for us to live socially so that we can tell the difference. Who's your mate? Who's your child? Who should you cooperate with and so forth? So we can use this capacity to go down a level from our groups and start seeing each other not as members of groups, but as individual human beings. We have this capacity. And in fact, this lied at the core of Martin Luther King's famous invocation. This also has been part of our society, that I would rather judge. He looked forward to a society in which people were judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And what he's saying is we should look at each other as individuals. So to sum up, when you have the problem of tribalism, when tribalism becomes too fulsome and begins to create issues for the broader population, you can either step up a level, taking advantage of our capacity to draw the boundaries of groups and say we're all members of the same group, or you can step down a level and use our capacity to detect and respond to people as individuals and treat them as individuals.
We're speaking with Nicholas Christakis, the author of Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Subaru in Auburn, Maine. Now renting new Subarus by the day or longer. Learn more at evergreensubaru.com. And Maine Association of Nonprofits, celebrating 25 years of powering the common good by helping nonprofits thrive in a fast-changing world. NonprofitMaine.org.
Joe Biden's long career in Washington has had moments that could be a liability for a presidential bid.
I haven't always been right. I know we haven't always gotten things right. But I've always tried.
How Biden's past might affect a presidential run this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Public News Tell Me More tour is underway, visiting many cities around the state over the next few months. The Tell Me More Tour is an effort for Maine Public News to hear directly from you and learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. The next stop is in Farmington this evening, starting at 5:30 at the University of Maine Farmington's Olson Student Center. This evening's Farmington event also will include Maine Public News reporter Fred Bever discussing his recent series, Power Struggle in the Maine Woods, around CMP's transmission project in western Maine. For more information about the Tell Me More Tour visits, visit mainepublic.org and click on the banner ad. Hope to see you in Farmington this evening.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, sociologist, physician, Yale professor, and author Nicholas Christakis. His new book is called Blueprint: The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Nicholas Christakis, looking at the calls and questions coming in, I have a feeling I'm going to have to leave a lot of my personal questions on the cutting room floor here. But I do want to ask you this before we go to the calls. I am sitting here in Maine in a studio about 30 miles from the Sabbath Day Shaker community. Shakers make an appearance in Blueprint. What does the Shaker experience teach us and teach you about human nature?
So part of the book, at the beginning, I review the history and the cases of human beings attempting to make a new society. If you really wanted to test some of the ideas that we're discussing, you would like to do an experiment in which you took a group of babies, let's say, and abandoned them on a small island and with plentiful food and let them grow up somehow themselves and see what kind of society they made. In other words, you could see what kind of natural society they would make by doing this awful thing. Now, this is clearly unethical and wrong. It's been called the forbidden experiment. It's been considered by powerful kings for thousands of years. Herodotus gives an example of an Egyptian pharaoh who took a couple of children and gave them to a mute shepherd in the mountains to see what language those children spoke when, if they just spoke naturally. He was trying to figure out what was the ancient tongue. This has been thought up in the past. Now, we couldn't do that. So what I thought about doing was, what would be some natural examples of this? And one class has to do with shipwrecks. So I look at the history of groups of people that were unintentionally isolated on a desert shore somewhere, 20 cases of at least 19 people that lived at least 2 months isolated from everyone else. What kind of society did they make? And examples of scientists that were in scientific, in Antarctic stations that were trying to build a society, or the Pitcairn, mutiny on the Bounty, and what did those people do on Pitcairn Island? And on and on. And also look at the history of utopian movements or sects, including the Shakers and the kibbutz in Israel, and many examples from the 19th century in this country and other parts of the world. What's amazing is, ever since Roman times, there have been groups of people who have said, our society is screwed up. We're going to strike out and make it all over again. And they go out and they attempt to do this, and they almost invariably fail. They're unable to make a new social order because we cannot escape the social suite. We cannot escape this blueprint. The Shakers are a very interesting example. They are one of the most successful, most long-lived utopian sects ever. And of course, they were undone because they didn't permit sex. So they ignored this necessity for loving attachment in our that is part of our human nature. But they were very long lived, and I don't know if the very last ones have yet died, but there were only 6 or 7 remaining Shakers as of 10 or 20 years ago, including at Sabbath Day, as you mentioned. Just as a footnote to that, I would say that all these utopian movements have faced the problem of addressing this issue of attachment, of friendship and love within human beings, and have responded to it in different ways. Because if you have a family unit, if you love your partner and your children more than the group, or if you have particularistic friends, like these are my friends within the larger group, that can sometimes be very stressful or threatening to a charismatic leader that's trying to set up a utopian movement, or can potentially threaten the unity of the group. So different utopian sects have responded to this threat that love for our partner, attachment to our partner, poses in paradoxically opposite ways. Some utopian sects say, okay, no sex. You can't love your partner, for example. Others say, okay, everyone has sex with everyone else. Polyamory. There's kind of an open community. Again, the purpose is to decrease your attachment to particular individuals. And that also is ultimately unsuccessful. So both of these extremes have arisen from the same sort of political necessity in these utopian sects over the years, neither of which has ultimately been successful.
We'll go to Jam, who's calling from Gorham. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to reference your Blueprint book. I'm sorry, I haven't been able to read it yet. But I have taken a class at University of Southern Maine, and it was titled Economics of Happiness, and taught by Professor Momgain. And I wanted to know, what do you see in the economics of happiness as far as the blueprint goes, and how is that at all relevant?
So you're alluding to an interesting set of scientific work or research that's been done over the last few years on the origins of human happiness and actually the scientific study of happiness. And for example, some of the most famous studies of that are that happiness does not rise linearly with wealth. So as you get richer and richer, eventually you plateau. So if you give someone who has $10,000 a year an extra $5,000, it makes them much happier. If you give someone with $100,000 a year an extra $5,000, it really doesn't have much effect. And one of the findings from that work is that when you kind of get to about $70,000 a year of income, additional money doesn't buy you much more happiness. It's a little debated, but that's roughly what's the story. But in that literature as well, and connected to what I'm talking about today, is the finding that the principal determinant of people's happiness is their social relationships. We have evolved to feel joy when we are near people who we feel connected to. So there's this deep relationship between attachment, whether to partners or to friends or to our groups, and this internal feeling we have of happiness. And it's just speaking for myself, there's really nothing that makes me happier than a small dinner party with two other couples. My wife and I, six of us, get together, have a conversation. At the end of the evening, I feel renewed. And this is a very common experience for many people.
Jan, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Cape Elizabeth and Paul. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. A question and a quick point. How do you factor in macro systems like, for example, patriarchal religion or competitive capitalism in shaping what we even understand to be good? And the quick point is, as we're all aware, news outlets and history books overvalue war and conflict stories. So that's what we tend to be presented to ourselves as what's going on in the world. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so I would answer that question in the following way by saying what I've been talking about have been the way human beings were shaped even before the onset of religion or before the onset of patriarchal systems of organization. It's the prehistorical forces that have shaped us for hundreds of thousands of years. And one sort of side way of making a similar point is to say that when we go study elephants, as I talk about, the elephants have friends too. And elephants form social networks which, when mapped, look indistinguishable from human social networks. The last common ancestor we had with elephants was 85 million years ago, was a small shrew-like animal which, as far as we know, did not live socially. So elephants have independently, by convergent evolution, evolved the capacity for friendship, long-term relationships with unrelated individuals. Incidentally, so have chimpanzees, so have dolphins, and so forth. And therefore, if we can share the capacity for friendship with animals, we can share this capacity with each other, with other humans. So it's these sorts of traits that preceded these other forces that you described that I would put in the historical category of sort of big god religions, for example, that appeared since the agricultural revolution, as far as we can tell, these sort of monotheistic religions that are often very hierarchical and have a priestly class, for example. Or this sort of patriarchal organization of our society, or many, not all societies, many societies are matriarchal, these forces that you describe, while very important, came quite late in the evolution of our human nature.
Paul, thanks for your question. Sharon asks on Facebook, Nicholas, I have used your work about social connection and the community of self-perception and identity to teach public health and epidemiology for years. I am interested in your ideas about community-based civil discourse and cross-political discussions. By the way, your lectures from Harvard available online are fantastic, too.
Yes, so I was at Harvard until recent, about 5 years ago, and then I moved to Yale. I'm glad to see those lectures still live on app, I guess, on iTunes or elsewhere, also on my website. But anyway, I would say that there are ways in which some of the ideas that are discussed in the book undergird civil society, and there's a connection between these evolutionary principles we've been discussing and a certain set of liberal, and here I mean classically liberal, political commitments. For instance, our Constitution instantiates or privileges the freedom of assembly. It privileges freedom of speech in the First Amendment. And the founders understood that they would be able to create a better society if they shaped one whose political rules more closely matched our innate nature. So the fact that we humans like to assemble, they understood that implicitly, if not explicitly they understood it, but they must have gathered. They understood it was part of our nature, and they made it a political right. The fact that we like to teach each other things requires open communication. We need us, in order to learn from each other, in order to be able to be the social learners that we are as a species, we had to have political rules that foster and permit that. So many of the foundational principles of a liberal democracy that we see in our society and that to my eye are so admirable and so wonderful, including this commitment to talk to each other, even across political lines, and to foster and that kind of debate and to allow and encourage us to assemble, those are built upon this evolutionary blueprint, even though they are historical and political forces of more recent origin.
An email from Michael. While I want to believe that humans are hardwired to be good, there must be something going wrong with the software applied to the hardware. We seem to be experiencing a regression toward the mean, pun intended. How does your guest explain what's happening?
Well, once again, the things are not so bad. Yes, there are problems. There's warfare, there are bombings, there's hatred. I'm not sort of, you know, this sort of starry-eyed optimist that doesn't see the problems in the world. But again, I would invite you to observe that even over historical time, let alone over the kind of evolutionary sweep that I'm speaking of, things have been getting better. The world is much better today than it was 50 years ago, than 100, than 1,000 years ago. And moreover, all of those forces, those historical and cultural forces, which I would think of as a kind of a thin veneer of civilization over top of our more primitive or ancient biological propensities, those biological propensities are themselves tending to the good. They are shaping our natural tendencies in all these wonderful ways we've discussed. Now, it is the case, as I said, that we are also prone to violence and hatred and extreme tribalism and selfishness and all of these awful things. But the good things necessarily outweighed the bad. And so I, and the historical forces are additive to those evolutionary forces. So I remain an optimist despite some of the manifest problems we still have.
And we have an email from...
Incidentally, it doesn't mean we don't occasionally have stepbacks. It's not like we're uniformly, and as it says, you know, it says in mathematics, monotonically, we're not just always getting better and better. Sometimes things get worse for a while before they resume a kind of upward trajectory.
We have an email that agrees with you, but maybe looks at it in a different perspective. This person, Dr. Sumner, writes, the media shapes our worldview. Yes, a few thousand people do horrible things every day, but a few billion do not. We point to the bad, the horrid, but ignore the good, the positive, the profound.
Yes, I mean, I quite agree with that. I mean, you know, I think you could ask, why have we evolved the preferential attention to bad news than good news? And there are interesting explanations for why natural selection might have equipped us for that. And the gist of it goes something like, it's better to know that there is a lion out there that might eat you than that there is a shrub that you might eat. That the spreading of bad news and the attention to things that might affect you imminently the having the brain capacity that pays more attention to those kinds of things on average might be better than having the brain capacity that pays relatively more attention to benign or good things. So there's a set of ideas as to why we are a kind of animal that, you know, pays attention to bad news, but you can understand it. But that doesn't mean, incidentally, that we also can't shape that or escape that or exploit a deeper understanding of our nature to make our society better.
We're going to take another quick break. We're talking with Nicholas Christakis, the author of Blueprint. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Green Hut Galleries, with Maine, the Painted State, a biennial invitational exhibition through April 27th, greenhutgalleries.com. And Salaam Circus School in Biddeford, offering year-round youth and adult circus arts classes, intensive training programs, and private lessons. Salaam Circus. On the next Speaking in Maine, the future of trade, technology, geography, and economic adjustment.
So if we want to fix the trade deficit, we need policies that are going to spur savings.
Robert Koopman is the chief economist at the World Trade Organization. He spoke at the World Affairs Council of Maine about his take on the future of trade. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Thursday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio. Celebrate spring this year at Maine Spring Live, Wildlife, Science, and You. Join Maine Public and Maine Audubon this Saturday morning from 10 to 3 p.m. at Gilsland Farm Sanctuary in Falmouth for this outdoor family festival. It's a chance to learn about citizen science, watch wild animal demonstrations, join guided bird walks, or learn about solar energy at Audubon's large solar array and more. Folks attending can connect with dozens of nature and science-focused organizations. It's a family-oriented event, and there will be food trucks on location as well. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events for details.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're speaking with Nicholas Christakis. He is a social scientist, physician, professor, and author, and his new book is entitled Blueprint. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to John calling from Wiscasset. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer. Great to hear Nicholas. I was unaware of the man. I'm going to be looking forward to listening to some of his stuff online. I have a couple of points. This country was founded on high ideals, but he never mentioned slavery and the genocide of the native peoples.
Yes. So a couple things in response to that. First of all, we have high ideals. We don't always live up to them. That's absolutely the case. But the genocide and the slavery that have been with us, unfortunately, since time immemorial, or actually since the agricultural revolution. Before that, we lived in small groups. So it was much harder for us to practice genocide and slavery when we lived as hunter-gatherers from about 300,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago. So that's the period of time in which the human nature was forged. That's the period of time in which we acquired a lot of these traits for love and friendship and cooperation and teaching and so forth that I've been talking about. Now, since the agricultural revolution and since the wealth, the possibility of the accumulation of wealth and therefore of wealth inequality, of substantial wealth inequality have arisen, and as well the nation states, the invention of cities, of course, the invention of mass communications, we've had a lot of other ways in which we have had more opportunities to be vile to each other, weapons of mass destruction, for example, that we, you know, we have a natural tendency, let's say, to murder each other, but now equipped with guns, we can actually do that with much greater efficiency. And slavery is another thing that's been practiced since time immemorial. During our historical times. So I'm not ignoring or negating or minimizing those things, but I'm highlighting the ways in which our nature was shaped even prior to these forces. And I do want to agree with you that while our ideals in our nation have always been good, we are still a work in progress. So we are still attempting to honor the commitments of our founding documents that, you know, man, humans are equipped with certain inalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we clearly have not extended those rights to everyone, but we're doing it more and more as time goes by. We're getting better and better, in my view.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Thank you, John, for that question. You're talking about how we, until very recently, as humans lived in small groups and were nomadic. That leads to a question from Isaac. How do conditions for humans today compare to the conditions which shaped our evolution? And are the same forces acting?
Yeah, so it's very different. But see, these conditions are quite different. But here's the thing. If you think about it, one of the reasons that many people are diabetic or that we're obese, that our society is, you know, we're getting bigger and bigger as a society, is our bodies evolved to cope with scarcity of food. But since the agricultural revolution and since the industrial revolution, it's become very easy to provide for the calorie needs of most humans in most parts of the world. Actually, even in those parts with famine, those are sort of human-caused, the famines. So there are plentiful calories available, and our bodies sort of suck these calories up, and we get heavier. The fats and the sugar, which were scarce in the past, we now see as, are very plentiful. And you could make an analogous argument that there are modern inventions which also steer us away from certain more, let's say, natural societies that we might be more likely to make. And I mentioned earlier, weapons of mass destruction, for example, would fall in that category. We might have always been prone to in-group bias, but when you suddenly equip us with nuclear weapons and maybe trigger happy leaders, we might wind up wiping each other out as a result of that. So I'm not saying that we are not at risk, and I'm not saying that we can neglect these historical forces, and I'm not saying that all historical forces, tend to make everything better and better. That's not the case. But I am saying that fundamentally, we humans are a good species, and we have been shaped to express these qualities. And I can support that argument in part by pointing to the ways in which evolution has shaped those analogous qualities, even in other animals, which have no history, which have no weapons, which have no religions, for instance. And yet those animals have these same qualities that we do.
We'll go to John calling from Orono. Hi, John. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm a member of a Native American tribe here in Maine, and I'm extremely offended by the guest's description of tribalism. It's either on his part, either a poor choice of words, or he has no understanding at all about tribes in this country. I've worked with tribes all over the United States, including Alaska, and most tribal people that I know all consider themselves to be inhabitants of planet Earth and just members of the human race. And they're constantly reaching out beyond their tribes to develop relationships with many, many people outside of their tribes.
Sure, John, I appreciate your call. And I have to say, I believe I used that word first. And I understand and we'll think about what you've said. But Nicholas Christakis, this phrase tribalism goes beyond Native American tribes.
No,
correct?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Native Americans. The caller is misunderstanding the use of the word. So tribalism is a technical term which means that a group of people thinks differently of themselves than they think of others. It has nothing to do with Native American tribes or tribes anywhere else in the world. It's a word which is used to also describe what we were talking about earlier, which is in-group bias, the us versus them, the tendency of people to think well of us and ill of them, which is seen in all humans and is seen everywhere, not just Native American tribes or anywhere else. And I even would agree that although Native American tribes were often at war with each other in historical time, I would say that there is a sense in which there is a it tends to be more common, this kind of sense of communal well-being, as near as we can tell from the anthropology and the living testament to some of these beliefs among Native American tribes. So the caller has misunderstood the use of the word tribalism.
John, thanks for your call. Jean Marie on Facebook says, what role, if any, does gender play in the types of behaviors that build positive social connections?
Well, I think, there are differences between men and women. But again, those are not the differences that interest me so much. I'm interested in what unites us, not what divides us. I'm interested in our common humanity. I'm interested in the ways in which we are all the same. And I would say that although there are differences between men and women, the more interesting thing to me is to explain why are both men and women equipped with these capacities that are so beneficent. Men and women both form friendships. Men and women both teach each other things. Men and women cooperate. Men and women love their partners. These are fundamental, deep, beautiful, wonderful qualities that we human beings have. and, you know, are not not the province of just one gender, or as the previous caller was saying, one group. So I in the book, I do talk a little bit about sort of male and female differences and how sort of we go about mating, for instance, you know, partner preferences, where those came from, how natural selection has acted differently on the males and females of our species, and incidentally, analogously on other species. But that's not the primary focus. My vision of us as people is that we are united by a kind of our common humanity, and that we can speak to each other via that common humanity and can understand each other even across all of these various boundaries that some of your callers have been highlighting.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Vienna. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you, and thank you, Nicholas. Calling from the Maine Resilience Building Network, and I would note that Stephen Porges describes how we actually are soft to hardwired with the 10th cranial nerve and parasympathetic nervous system. These have evolved to help us engage socially, empathize, communicate, problem solve, develop resilience, and inhibit fight or flight or freeze stress responses. These aren't guaranteed, and they have to be renewed every parent-to-child generation, but it's there as an option, and I'd be glad to put some reference on the Facebook site. Thank you.
I'm not sure. Was there a question there that I missed, Jennifer?
I don't think so. I'm just wondering if you wanted to respond.
I think he was discussing, well, I mean, he's discussing other ways in which our social interactions, sort of physiologic features of our bodies that relate to how we interact with each other. So, you know, the allusion to the fight or flight response and to certain endocrine and other neurologic features that we have. I would say that the more abstract or the point I would make to picking up what the caller said is that these capacities for social interaction have been written into our bodies. So earlier we were talking about our faces all being different one from another, which is odd for an animal. We have faces different from one another. The regions of our genome that shape that give rise to the way our faces look are prone to a great amount of variability, and that has been shaped by natural selection. So many of the social abilities we have, such as having different faces or having parasympathetic nervous systems that respond in certain ways to stress, actually are internalized reflections of the fact that we live socially.
Mark, thanks for your call. Most of human history, Nicholas Christakis, took place before the advent of the internet. Most of evolution took place before the advent of the internet.
Yes.
How do you believe social media and how it magnifies and speeds natural human interaction changes the blueprint, changes society's capacity to be good?
Well, I mean, I would say that social media is to real friendship the way pornography is to real love. I mean, we have these natural tendencies and we invent technologies that exploit these natural tendencies. So, you know, the interest we have in each other, which is very large, we're social animals. We pay attention to relative status. We pay attention to who's whose friend, who's whose enemy, who's getting along, who's saying what. You know, we are interested in gossip and rumors and so forth. You know, that then gives rise, let's say, to the soap, you know, soap opera industry, where everyone is, you know, watching these soap operas. We're riveted by them because it's naturally very appealing to us. And I think the social media are also grafted on to this very fundamental tendency that we have. You can have overexpression of these traits. So, for example, one of our qualities, which is very interesting, is our capacity to is known as de-individuation. When we're in a group, we can sometimes be struck with awe, for example, or we can suspend our own individual interests and act as part of a group and take the collective interest at heart. Now, this is very advantageous for many challenges. If we're trying to cross the tundra together or trying to kill a big animal as a group, for example. But this capacity to surrender ourselves to the group can also lead to mob behavior and riots and violence, and where people surrender themselves to the group and feel like they're no longer individual agents. So you can have a kind of overexpression of that. And I would see social media as being a kind of overexpression of a natural tendency to friendship, abetted by a kind of modern technology.
Nicholas Christakis, now that you've completed Blueprint, which is really a remarkable book, what's next for you? What's your next book? What's your next big project?
Oh, well, I'm beginning to think about another book. It just takes me about 10 years to write a book, partly because I'm also doing a bunch of other things at the same time. So I haven't yet decided what the next book would be. But my lab is doing research around the world, trying to, and online, trying to take advantage of some of these ideas to make the world better. So, for example, we're working in developing world countries where we are trying to take an understanding of human social interaction and apply it in ways that get villages or groups of people to take better care of their children, or to reduce violence, or to increase economic productivity, to sort of develop better. So we are exploring ways in which we can take these ideas and apply them to make the world better.
Can you give us an example of one?
I mean, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So one example.
We've got a couple minutes.
Okay. So we're working in Honduras right now, and what we can do there in Western Honduras, we've also been working in India and Uganda and in many American locations and online. But you can map a social network, and you can use mathematical tools to identify who in that network occupies a position within the friendship network, such that if they change their behavior, it will create positive ripple effects because of our natural tendency to all of these things that we've been discussing today, to copy each other, to learn from each other, to cooperate with each other, to befriend each other, and so forth. And so if you go into these villages and you teach particular individuals, for example, how to breastfeed their kids or how to vaccinate their kids, or you attempt to reduce intimate partner violence as we do, you can then create or foster these artificial tipping points, these kind of beneficial cascades of good behaviors, precisely by taking advantage of an understanding of human nature, by taking advantage of an understanding of how it is that we live together, to intervene in groups to make us even better able to live together well.
Well, it's also fascinating. Professor Christakis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicholas Christakis is a sociologist, physician, and author of the new book, Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Isaac Merson took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as all sorts of resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we celebrate nature, the arrival of spring, and talk about citizen science, all in connection with a new PBS documentary. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.